Welcome, everyone. We're beginning session one of Living the Divine Life series. You know, Baba says that there are three different stages of life that we all live, but these stages can actually be stretched out over many lifetimes. Before we even get on the path of the moral life, there's a sub-moral life, which is led by criminals and people who are very anti the light and anti-God. Then when we get on the spiritual path, the first stage is the moral life. We believe that the world of duality is real. Then we graduate at some point to the spiritual life, where we live in qualified non-duality. We realize theoretically the world isn't real, but we're still caught. This is a stage where we not only understand the concept that we are Atma, or divine love, but we find that we begin to wield our light with purposefulness and consciousness. We begin to attract through the magnetism of our own hearts, having done our spiritual work, others toward us, so that we may then begin our function as teachers and healers, knowing that in actuality, all are Atma, all are spirit, but not all know that. The first part of this series is clearing the blocks to inner peace. I'd like to mention something I've said before. I know that most of you know this, but it always bears mentioning, and that is that all religions, all spiritual paths, have a sacred mystical path to realization. If we are discussing Hinduism, that path is Advaita. If it's Buddhism, as you know, it's Zen. If it's Islam, as you know, it's Sufism. If it's Christianity, it's mystical Christianity, the lives of the saints, and the attunement or constant communion with God known as practicing the presence. If it's Judaism, it's the sacred Kabbalah, or the mystical experience of the God within. When we discover that we are that majesty, that we are divinity itself, it seems that we are drawn into an ever deepening experience of that, in the sense that we are given the opportunity to articulate the experience, which of course can't be done, and to convey to others how they might access with that within themselves, so that their light shines without interruption, and they may begin to discover that the ego is actually not real, and that there is a way to transcend the egoic self and to rest in the peace of the heart. I'm always looking for streamlined ways to teach other people after I've mastered a process or a quality. There is a common saying in the United States that people teach what they most want to learn. I would say that's not very effective. If we're teaching something we haven't mastered in the way of a quality or a characteristic or a discipline, then that teaching that we exude will have no Shakti whatsoever. It will just be words. It will be a concept that is being conveyed intellectually. But when we have mastered a quality or an essence or an aspect, then when we speak, others will get that through an energetic transmission, whether we speak or not. We could sit silently and others will be moved. An example of this is Ramana Maharshi. Another example would be Ramakrishna. During this series, Living the Divine Life, we're going to be touching on aspects of A Course in Miracles, which, of course, is Christian Vedanta, and Ramana's teachings, Ramesh Balsekar, and any number of teachers from all of the world's disciplines, because the saints of all the world's religions and spiritual paths belong to all of us. As they say, there are no walls in heaven. The walls of consciousness, the barriers which separate us from each other, are only man-made, and ultimately the great carousel of illusion has to be dismantled. It has to be evaporated. We have to see through it and see that although we may have enjoyed the seeming fun and the thrill and the attraction of the ups and downs of the carousel of life, that ultimately there are no ups and downs, and we come to see through the veil of illusion and also the pairs of opposites. I'd like to begin by reading you something from the text of A Course in Miracles. And it talks about the obstacles to peace, which of course are within ourselves. As peace extends from deep inside yourself to embrace all the sonship and give it rest. It will encounter many obstacles. Some of them you will try to impose. Others will seem to arise from elsewhere, from your brothers, and from various aspects of the world outside. Yet peace will gently cover them, extending past them completely unencumbered. The extension of the Holy Spirit's purpose from your relationship to others to bring them gently in will quietly extend to every aspect of your lives, surrounding both of you with glowing happiness and the calm awareness of complete protection. And you will carry its message of love and safety and freedom to everyone who draws nigh unto your temple, where healing awaits for him. You will not wait to give him this, for you will call to him, and he will answer you, recognizing in your call the call for God. And you will draw him in and give him rest as it was given to you. I've often said that it's extremely helpful if we are multilingual in spirit. I learned a long time ago that to try to cheerlead other people to jump on the bandwagon of A Course in Miracles or the teachings of Sai Baba or any of the other practices and teachings which I have experienced and implemented in past decades was really quite futile. Everyone is on his correct path, and it may not be my path. Many times I would be so enthusiastic, and I simply couldn't understand why family members or friends or associates just didn't quite get my joy and happiness and understand the miracles that were happening for me. When I joined the 12 Steps many, many years ago for families and friends of alcoholics, I couldn't understand why all my neighbors wouldn't want to just go to the meetings because they had alcoholic and problems in their families, drug addicts in their families, and so on, and they just seemed so unhappy and discouraged, but there was no response. I finally realized that God is in charge, not me, and that my attempts to control other people were also very addictive, and that fell in the category of codependence. I also realized that I had an addiction to food, and that when I began to feel anxious and concerned, that I would try to muffle my feelings with food. So I began to see that I'm the only one that needs to have correction, and that self-discipline and self-control are the essential aspects of every spiritual aspirant's life, and humility is step one. We get to have many repeat servings of humble pie along the way. It's not bad when you get used to it. There's an old saying that the teacher and the student together create the teaching. Ultimately, I learned to speak the spiritual language of the Course in Miracles, of 12 Steps, of Sai Baba's teachings, also of fundamental Christianity, because I was surrounded by many fundamental Christians, of Catholic Christianity, of New Thought Christianity, and of interfaith Christianity, of Sufism, of Buddhism, and of Advaita within Hinduism. And what I discovered was that within all paths are the ancient timeless values of peace, truth, right action, nonviolence, and right conduct. When we realize that there are no adversaries, that the ego throws up walls and throws up blocks to try to keep us in fear so that it can have control, then we begin to realize that by watching our thoughts, not judging them, not evaluating, not trying to deny them or muffle them, but just to watch our thoughts, then we will begin to not take so seriously our dialogues, our mental patterns, our cultural conditioning, our gender conditioning, and the impulses that we have, which are actually from ego. Now, it's very important when you have a spiritual teacher, whether it's a parent or a guru or a mentor, that first we learn the principles, we understand what they are, then we implement them, we refine them, and we make them our own. And it's only after understanding them, implementing them, living them, and refining them that we're able to be able to convey them to other people in a very streamlined way that is uniquely ours, so that we have our own language that comes from our experience. We have owned this, and we're able to resonate with another's heart and do a lot of self-revelation coming from our own experience about how we, too, had a particular problem, situation, a series of difficulties, and what brought peace and comfort to us, so that they, in fact, might or might not resonate with that. Always, this is given selflessly, without any expectation of even gratitude or thanks or any sort of reward in return. Keeping in mind the fact that lightworkers are waking up now to the fact that for decades most of us have been on a spiritual path or a number of paths with one or more spiritual teachers, that we are now being called to teach. We're now being called to share our wisdom, share our music, share our knowledge, our teaching, our yoga instruction, whatever it is that is our métier, our particular avenue of teaching and healing. It's a very good cover for connection in the heart with other people, whatever it happens to be. It could be pumping gas, it could be teaching school, it could be taking blood pressure as a nurse. It doesn't matter. Whatever we do is a very good cover for who we are, which is the light of the world. We're all Atma. We're all the light of the world. Now, just recently, I read the book, The One-Minute Teacher, looking for ways to streamline ways to teach spirituality. As you may know, The One-Minute Teacher by Dr. Spencer and Constance Johnson has been a bestseller. It's highly recommended for all lightworkers and is a fast read. It has three very simple principles: to create for yourself one-minute goals, to review them every day, to give yourself one-minute praisings when you reach a goal, and also to give yourself one-minute corrections. Now, when you create your one-minute recoveries, you can make a mistake, and you can also allow that you have made your mistake. It's not the end of the world. In fact, if you haven't made any mistakes in your life, you probably haven't done anything, because mistakes are how we grow. So hopefully you've made lots of mistakes, and hopefully you don't remember any of them and you're not beating yourselves up about them. Finally, as I said, you give yourself a one-minute praising when you complete a task. The reason I'm telling you this is that we are teachers all day long by our example. We're teachers to children, we're teachers to colleagues, teachers to family members, teachers to people all around us. For example, now, if I have a goal to complete my office project by Friday at noon, I set the goal, I work on it a few hours every day, I finish it by Thursday. This is what happened to me recently. Then I realized I had omitted some important information on my project, and then I had to give myself a one-minute recovery correction, but there was a temptation to just decide, oh, well, I can put that project off till next week, even though I had promised some other people I would have it done. And once again, there was the temptation to cave in to comfort, to fun, to relaxation, to procrastination, and to put my own comfort needs first rather than to take the higher road and to put a little pressure on myself to honor the other person I had given my commitment to. So I made the one-minute correction. I was able to work a few more hours to correct the project, to complete it by Friday, and to make my completion of my commitment to myself and to the other person. Now, I would just like to tell a story about The Karate Kid, the first movie, The Karate Kid. You may remember having seen that, where the movie has many, many lessons in it. But I have found I've taken great heart and comfort from Mr. Miyagi. Mr. Miyagi is the Japanese man who hired Daniel, a teenage boy, to come to his house to do odd jobs and to start by painting a fence. He was really much more to Daniel than just an employer. He was supposedly trading karate lessons for fence painting and for other odd jobs. Mr. Miyagi is the quintessential mentor, and he taught us a number of things. One of the first lessons happens when Daniel learns to paint the fence, and he understands that first you show up for the job. When we show up, we have to be on purpose and we have to be present for any job, whether the job is something we're doing for ourselves or we're doing for pay or we're doing a service to another. We have to be dependable, and if we don't show up, then we need to get a replacement, or we need to say why we're not going to show up, or we need to say why we didn't show up so we just don't leave people hanging and waiting and waiting and waiting for us to come. Secondly, you have the right tools and the right equipment to do the job. In that case, it was a fence, paint, brushes, and an instructor. Three, you listen to instructions. You don't think, yeah, I know how to do this. I'll figure it out. No, you pay exquisite attention to the instructions, and you listen to your heart. And if you don't understand the instructions, you ask questions. So it's never a foolish question. Four, you carry out your instructions exquisitely, paying close attention to painting as an art form. If you're painting a fence, you don't just slap through the job so that you can get your pay or get your karate lesson or get on to the next thing. If we're always slapdashing through life and we're never present in the moment, having a relationship with the fence we're painting or whatever it is we're doing, then we're never present. And we were never present for our life. We just schlepped along thinking of something else, waiting to get to the next thing, using every person that we have met, using every situation as merely a stepping stone for the next thing. And that's called using and abusing other people, and using, abusing, and abusing ourselves and time by not being present. So our attention is the most precious gift we can give to ourselves and anyone else. And number five, you perform your work as worship, and then time stands still, and then you're in peace. And you do an excellent job. You enjoy the work. You feel good about yourself and your fine work. You develop a high standard for yourself. And then after you have set the high standard, you maintain the high standard. You can give yourself an acknowledgement. I love the way I painted that fence. It was so fun. Time flew by. It looks really good, if I say so myself. No gaps, no missed places. It looks good. The fence seems happy. I'm happy. I gave my best painting to the fence. You may or may not get praised by other people, but you acknowledge that you set and met your goal to a high standard. Then you never need to hanker for the recognition of others because you are the setter and achiever of the one-minute goals that you set for your life. That means that you are the one that is the arbiter of your destiny. You are the one that acknowledges and feels and lives to your own dharma. Now, many, many times when I've hired high school students to do odd jobs and yard work, I've thought of Mr. Miyagi and how to instruct a worker to set a one-minute goal and to do a good job, stay in the moment, enjoy the work, set and keep a goal to a high standard, and give himself a one-minute praising when he completes the work or make a one-minute recovery if he makes a mistake. That way, he doesn't need me to hold his hand all the way through the job. He understands the directions. I quiz him to see if he has understood the directions. And then he's the one who is his own employer. You know, there's a saying that when we stay in peace within, we're fulfilling our dharma or our life purpose. And Native Americans have a saying about that. Who are we to insult the Creator and not to do the work that we are here to do? Who are we to insult the Creator and not do the work that we are here to do? Work grounds us in our home. It grounds us in our family. It grounds us in the neighborhood. It grounds us in the community and the state and the society. It helps us to understand our contribution to the whole and how we are needed by the whole. Every single person. Every person. Handicapped people. People in comas. People that are uneducated. People who are illiterate. They may have the heart that the highly literate people around them need. They may be able to see and hear in a special way and to be able to say, excuse me, have you thought of this? In discussing clearing the blocks to inner peace, I would like to mention that one of the foremost exponents of A Course in Miracles is Dr. Ken Wapnick. And he has given many workshops and he even wrote a book on the obstacles to peace. As the Course in Miracles indicates, the four obstacles to peace are, number one, the desire to avoid peace and the attraction of guilt. Number two, believing the body offers something of value. Number three, the attraction to death. And number four, the fear of God. I would like to say, since we did a long series on the Yoga Sutras of Patanjali, that these same concepts are embedded within the Yoga Sutras, they're embedded within the Kabbalah and within mystical Christianity and also within Buddhism. They are found everywhere over and over, slightly different phrasings according to the culture and the values of the people that practice that particular orientation to the celebration of God within. Now, I'd like to mention that in regard to the first block, the desire to avoid peace and the attraction of guilt, that the attraction of guilt produces fear of love. I remember keenly that when I was a teenager, I was highly rebellious, and there were so many teachers, as well as my parents, who were trying to reach out to me, trying to offer love. And it was only years later that I suddenly became aware of all the ways they had tried to give their love, they had extended their patience, I had tried their patience, and I simply was an inert stone, and my heart was very stony, and my rebelliousness and my arrogance and my pride and the conceit of youthfulness, which is universal. So we find that the attraction of guilt produces a fear of love. Now, addicts in particular have a fear of love, and that's what the addiction is designed to do. Alcohol, tobacco, drugs, food, promiscuity, controlling relationships, workaholism, all of these things are designed to fill the hole in our hearts with a substance rather than to allow the deep experience of the ambiguity at first of the love that we are. We're so afraid that when we look within, we're going to see ugliness and terror, but what we find ultimately when we look within is tremendous love, because we are that. There's nothing else that we will find when we really look deeply except the love that we are. And then there is usually tremendous weeping and tremendous release. And then when we are at our bottom, we say, okay, Lord, I give up. My way isn't working. I'm ready now. I'm reachable and teachable. I'm ready to hear what you have in mind. So we come to a point where we bottom out on one thing or another, and then we can begin. And then we can be Krishna's flute. Then we can be the pencil in God's hands, as Mother Teresa says. Once, a long time ago, an addict told me that he had always loved the high of his drugs, but the inevitable crashes unbalanced him so badly with despair and anger and depression for weeks and months. And finally, he came to realize that he just simply could not afford the highs because the lows brought him so low, and he couldn't bounce back as quickly as he could have earlier. So this series shows us how to have the highs without the crashes. And speaking of crashes, I would just like to mention that we had a tremendous surprise on May the 5th. On May the 5th of this year, it was 9:15 at night, and we were quietly reading in the living room, and all of a sudden there was the most enormous crash outside. We had no idea what it was. Now, I have said prayers continually since we moved to Harmony Farm 12 years ago, that all people that come to this land, everyone who walks in the door, will be guided and protected as they leave their houses until they get here and as they get back in their houses at night or in the daytime, that everyone who operates any vehicle or any equipment or machinery will always be protected. And we have asked that sentinels position and station themselves in perpetuity around the perimeters of Harmony Farm, that angelic beings will quicken the awareness and quicken the hearts of all who come here toward their own healing, and that just by coming to the vibration of the land, they will experience more of the peace, the love, the light, and the power that they are. And that if there were ever anything that were not what I am speaking now, that we would be in a position to help, to rescue, to assist, to offer refuge, to offer healing to anyone in any emergency ever. On May the 5th at 9:15, we heard an enormous banging and clanging and crash, and it sounded as if a vehicle had hit the bridge beside our house. And we wondered how it could be that there was a very loud bang, 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 clatter, clatter, crash, and then total silence. So we ran outside. Jim ran ahead of me, and he saw in the darkness, as our neighbor was coming with a flashlight, that there was a very large, odd, strange, unrecognizable object hanging in our willow trees, which are 40 feet tall. With a sense of ominousness, we all approached this tree, which was perhaps in which this object was lodged. It was 4 or 5 feet off the ground. And we crept over to the object and discovered that it was some kind of vehicle. But the front end of the vehicle had smashed into the front windshield, and it was not discernible whether it was a car or a truck or what it was. The wheels were spinning around, and as we came upon it with our flashlights, we gasped and realized the back end was a truck. The front end was totally unrecognizable, and someone had obviously been speeding down the road, hit the bridge, gone out of control, fallen off the bank, and fallen into our trees, and the trees had actually stopped the vehicle and probably saved the person's life. Speaking of which, where was the driver? Since the front end of the car was totally folded up onto the windshield was not apparent because the engine of the car was there, and the hood had flown off, and there were metal pieces all over. Jim and our neighbor heard this gurgling sound and thought it was the radiator. And they put their flashlights on the ground and saw that it looked like radiator fluid was dripping. And then they realized it was blood and that the driver's head was underneath the glove compartment. And then we all realized simultaneously, quick, we have to call 911. So I ran in the house, called 911 and said, quickly, quickly, please, this is our address. We have had a very bad accident, a solo vehicle lodged in our willow trees. I don't know if there's been a fatality. Send everything you have. Send a rescue squad. Send paramedics. Send the ambulance. Flight for Life. Everything you have. Quickly, quickly. So, and you may need to cut the vehicle out of the trees, and you may need to cut the driver out of the vehicle. Within 7 minutes, there were vehicles there. Within 15 minutes, there were 11 vehicles. There was a Flight for Life helicopter. There were the police cordoned off the road at both ends. There were giant lights shining on the trees, on the vehicles. People were running everywhere. They asked us if we had a chainsaw so that they could cut the door out and be able to see if they could find the driver inside and then get the driver out. They started to shine big lights on the interior of the car and discovered that the driver's feet were up by the driver's window, and that the head was indeed down underneath the glove compartment. They began then to scan the ditch, the canal, right beside the bridge to see if there had been another passenger or a dog that might have flown out of the vehicle and fallen down into the water. It was a very busy scene with about 15 or 20 people running up and down the hill, up and down the yard, back and forth across the bridge, in and out of their vehicles, calling on their walkie-talkies and CDs, contacting the helicopter. And meanwhile, this enormous peace came over me, and I went into witness consciousness and just stood there observing what was happening, just feeling that light was coming from my heart. I was on hand to help if help were needed in any way, realizing that there is no life, there is no death, there is no birth, there is no death, that all is just as it is in this moment, and that everything was under control. Everything was as it was. If the driver were in the body, he was in the body. If he'd left the body, he'd left the body. But who we are never goes anywhere, never dies. Bodies come and go. But who we are is always present. Eventually, all of the equipment left the scene, the wrecker came and sawed the vehicle out of the trees and carried it away. And it occurred to me the next day to call the hospital to find out what had happened to the driver. I was asked if I were a member of the family, and I said, no, I was the one who called 911, and I'm very interested in knowing about this individual because I would like to start a prayer chain for him or her. And they said, well, this is the name of the person. I can tell you the person lives in your vicinity within a couple of miles. The person was intoxicated, and he will lose his license, and he had severe head trauma. He's not expected to live. And we can't tell you anything else more than that. He's in intensive care, and if you come, you will not be allowed to see him. So you had just better forget about this. Well, I thought, oh, well, all right, this is a good lesson to just surrender to Baba. Baba's in charge of everything. We'll just see what happens. Meanwhile, I was just praying that the family of the individual be strengthened, that the individual receive clarity, that if the individual went to the light, that he was just able to keep on going following the light, but that if the person were still going to be in the body, that he would learn all lessons required from the situation, and that he would be able to have some capacity, if it were God's will, to function and to be able to carry on life without being a burden to himself or others unless it was God's will. And I kept releasing this, but then from time to time, tapping in, called the hospital again. They said, we have no information about this person. So I thought, oh my goodness, perhaps he left his body and has left the plane. Did not think about this, except to just send prayers in his direction, not knowing whether he was in this plane or the other plane. Then about 3 weeks later, I received a call saying, hello, this is so-and-so. Yes. Are you the one that called 911? Yes, I am. Well, I'm the one that was in the car, and I'm out of the hospital now. I had severe head trauma, but by the grace of God, I have no plastic surgery. I had no broken bones, just a tremendous amount of swelling, and I'd like to come and see you and thank you in person. I said, well, it's not necessary to thank us. You would have done the same for us. We would have done the same for anyone. It was just God that saved you. No, no, I want to come. The individual came a few days later and sat down on the front porch, and we had lemonade, and said, you know, if I hadn't been so determined that my will had always been supreme, I wouldn't have been inebriated, flying down the road after being at the bar, working 18-hour days for months, totally being heedless of my family. He said, if that bridge hadn't been beside your house and you didn't have these trees and I hadn't just hit the embankment and landed in your trees, then I could have landed out here in the fields in this ranch land and could have fallen off the road and there would have been no one to know that I was there. I could have bled to death. And so I'm so thankful that I landed in your yard, so to speak, rather than just alone in the middle of ranch country. And I just wanted to thank you. I said, no thanks necessary. He said, you know, I learned so much from this. What I learned was that as soon as I came to and I got out of intensive care, my wife told me, I've put her through so much because this is not the first time something like this has happened. She said, I'm glad you're alive now. I'm leaving you. My children said, yes, we're leaving you. My parents said, yes, we've had it. You've given us so much heartbreak. We're leaving you. My boss said, we don't need you anymore. You are too expensive a liability for us. He said, I've lost my home, I've lost my family, I've lost my job, I've lost my driver's license, I've lost everything. I said, well, you haven't lost God, and you haven't lost this invaluable experience that will come in handy at some time in the future. You have your physical form, you have your mind, you have your abilities and skills, you have a great deal. And it sounds as if you're ready to start over. He said, yes. It's just going to take a miracle. I said, yes, well, miracles happen every day, and I'm sure they will happen for you. May we keep you on our prayer list? Oh, yes, I would be so grateful. Well, good. It would be our joy to do that.